Today on Main Calling, humanoid robots of the past, present, and future. Robots with human traits have been part of our popular culture for decades. Rosie the Robot in The Jetsons, C-3PO on Star Wars, robot hosts in Westworld that have feelings and self-awareness, and most recently the security robot in the TV series Murderbot that looks just like actor Alexander Sarsgaard. I'm Cindy Hahn. It's not only fictional robots that are everywhere. The explosion of AI and advanced technology is making working humanoid robots a reality. The world's biggest tech investors have sunk billions into developing them. Today, we'll learn what robots are currently capable of doing and what is still too futuristic to achieve. Can robots ever have real emotions? Why do humanoid robots continue to capture the imagination? Main Calling is coming right up.
Main Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
This is Main Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. Robots today range from self-propelled vacuum cleaners to package sorting machines, but robots that look and talk like human beings are still the kind that people find the most intriguing. Scientists and tech firms all over the world are pouring vast resources into developing them. Why do humanoid robots fascinate us, and how close are they to being able to act just like people? Joining me, Gabriel Margolis is a PhD student with MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory, known as CSAIL. And Fernando Nascimento is Assistant Professor of Digital and Computational Studies at Bowdoin College. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you have a favorite robot from TV or the movies? What do you want to know about today's robotic technology? Send an email to talk@mainpublic.org. You can post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. And there are plenty of humanoid robots that we've all been exposed to through popular culture. Here is a blast from the past.
We do have one old demonstrator model with a lot of mileage. Rousey!
Coming, sir. Here I am, sir. Yes, sir.
The old girl's still eager, isn't she? But of course, very H-O-M-E-L-Y.
I may be homely, Buster, but I'm S-M-A-R-T smart.
Of course, that was Rosie the Robot from the old TV show The Jetsons. And Gabe, I don't know, you're a PhD student. Are you old enough to remember or know of Rosie from The Jetsons?
Well, maybe not in the original airing, but I've definitely known of her. Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about some of the robots that we have known from books or shows or movies, and why it is we like our robots to have human qualities.
Yeah. So, well, growing up myself, I definitely enjoyed the robots in Star Wars, you know, R2-D2, C-3PO. I think we enjoy robots that have human qualities because inherently we're kind of human centric in our thinking about the world. I mean, if you think about it, humans are kind of special objects in the world, right? There are a lot of inanimate objects and there are a lot of animals that walk around, but you know, our interactions with humans are really unique. And I think people ascribe to robots a lot of extra behaviors based on their appearance. What people see guides what they expect from a robot. So if they see a humanoid robot, they expect kind of a higher level of intelligence that's near a human's. And I think that's definitely exciting to people.
Yeah, I get that. And Fernando, you grew up in Brazil. Were you exposed to Rosie the Robot or other things that made you interested in this field?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And the Jetsons were like very popular down there. But I really loved other like sci-fi related robots like Data from Star Trek. And one thing that I like about him, and I think it's connected to your question, Cindy, is the fact that he made us think about humanity. Well, he was trying to understand human emotions. And that's, I think, one of the ways in which robots and humanoids catch our attention.
But a lot of those humanoid robots that we've been exposed to through the popular culture are both appealing but scary to us as and what is the element that frightens us about these mechanical human beings, Fernando?
Yeah, and I think that if you think, for instance, robots like Terminator, and it's the I think that it's their potential power and their ability to overcome human control, and that's a discussion that is applicable these days not only to robots but also to artificial intelligence itself. So I think that that's the element of losing control that is behind the fear that some robots trigger on us.
And Gabe, you work actually with the technological side of robots, which is, we'll get quite a bit into that. But when you're defining a humanoid robot in the movies, it's that they can both think and communicate like humans, but also physically able to perform the movements and tasks like humans. Is that the goal for anyone who is creating an actual humanoid robot to get the physical and the mental sides of the equation right?
So I think researchers have a pretty diverse definition of what a humanoid robot is. Some people would say that a humanoid robot needs to be completely morphologically identical to a human. So it needs to have two legs, two arms, five-fingered hands, a head, things like that. Others define it as kind of some components of that. Maybe it's a wheeled base with two hands. But I think the important definition is that a humanoid robot can learn meaningfully from humans when it comes to how to do tasks. There's some correspondence there. And by building the robot like a human, the robot can also learn from human demonstrations.
So you really do have to model it on actual people as you're developing the hardware part of it.
Well, I think there are different techniques, and some of them benefit from modeling the robot on humans through this sort of increased data collection potential, and others don't necessarily. But I think really the idea behind making it humanoid is to learn from human data and also to put it in all of the environments that humans can operate in. So an alternative would be that we can engineer a specialized robot for each task, and that's already what you see in a lot of the industrial robots that are deployed today. But the challenge there is engineering each new robot takes a new team of engineers a lot of time to sort of redo these steps, even if the steps are established for a new task. And then you have some production issues because you need production lines for each of the robots. I think really the vision a lot of people have behind a humanoid robot is that you build one robot that can do all the tasks humans can do because it's shaped like a human, and then you just have one big production line that you can scale it much more efficiently.
So yeah, we know that there are these machines on wheels or other things that, help in manufacturing, help in packaging, all those types of ways that it's already happening. But the work you're doing, tell us about what's happening at MIT in the actual humanoid robots that are really able to walk or move and maybe pick things up. Where does that stand? That's a big question. How far along are we?
Definitely. So a lot of my work is on giving these robots motor skills. And in the past, I've worked with quadruped robots, so robot dogs, and more recently, humanoid robots. And by motor skills, we mean locomotion, manipulation, sort of these primitives that you can use to complete tasks. And I work less on the cognitive side of, the robot deciding what task it should do, although there is a lot of work on that. I think one interesting point to consider, like it might not be obvious to you that these motor skills need that much intelligence because they're kind of natural and simple for humans, right? If you want to pick up an object, you don't need to think too much about it. But in robotics, we have a concept called the Moravec's paradox, which is essentially that a lot of easy seeming cognitive tasks are actually difficult for computers, and conversely, a lot of tasks that seem hard to humans are easy for computers. For example, we have computers that can play expert level chess, right? Which is an extremely demanding cognitive task that I think, well, they can play better than the best humans, right? But we still don't have robots that can pick up an object better than even, you know, the average or probably the least capable human at picking up objects. So I think that, right, these tasks are kind of flipped in terms of how easy they are for humans, how easy they are for robots, which can be counterintuitive, but actually giving the robots motor skills is a big research area. And so also to mention kind of the technology that I'm developing or working on. So we train the motor skills leveraging a lot of simulated learning. So the idea is that if we want the robot to learn how to walk, we could allow it to practice in the real world, but there would be a lot of pitfalls to this. First, it could take a really long time. And second, the robot could be damaged because it's falling over and over again until it learns to succeed. And these robots can definitely break when they fall. And so by instead collecting the data and doing the training in a simulator, we resolve both of those things. First, the simulator can run much faster than the real world. So we can collect, you know, years of data in hours. And second, when the robot falls in simulation, nothing breaks and we don't have to pay for robot repairs. So this kind of simulation to reality learning paradigm is working really well for some motor skills, but there's also some ways to go to human level performance.
Yeah, so even though AI is here and making everything happen so much faster and develop so much more effectively, you still picking up a cup for a robot is something that is not such an easy thing. If you change the cup, you've programmed it to do one cup. If you change the cup, it's like you have to start all over again, right?
Yeah, and I think one other point about, well, so why does Moravec's paradox exist? I think that, and why do we have, right, so we have chess playing AIs, we have ChatGPT, which is an amazing chatbot agent. So like what explains this? I think one explanation is that there is a lot of data out there. For example, ChatGPT can easily be, well, the way you train it is you download the whole internet worth of text and you tell it, imitate this text, right? And that works really well. That's lots of great high quality, I mean, mixed quality, but some of it's high quality training data for a chatbot, right? The problem for a robot picking up the cup is if you want to apply the same paradigm, you don't have an internet's worth of data of robots picking up cups. Robots have never picked up cups before. So you have to generate a lot of the data from scratch. And that's, I think, where a big part of the challenge comes.
Right. Yeah. So Fernando, you know, speaking of ChatGPT, so that side of the equation, we're there, right? Like the ability for AI chatbots to simulate a human conversation are complete. I was thinking of the Alan Turing, right? The famous statement that if you can get a computer to write something like a human and fake somebody out, that is the essential like definition of thinking, that it's intelligent and it can think. So we're there, right? So that side of the robot is actually happening now.
Yeah, it is. And I, as Gabe said, there's then the problem of the other ways we perceive and we act in the world, because language is a proxy to some of those things, but our mechanical skills, they have to be created from other models. But one thing that's very interesting is that now ChatGPT, the same mechanism used for ChatGPT is used also for images and videos. So you may have seen the new forms of video creation, and that's a really interesting, there's a really interesting connection with robots there, because part of what they try to do when they create a video is to understand the physics of the world, to create a model of the physics of the world that could be reused to train robots. So I think that there is this is a very interesting connection between where we are in terms of large language models and multimodal models, and where robots will come in and get those models of the world and act upon them.
And I understand that one thing people are optimistic that even if it's a long time before humanoid robots can actually, do all the tasks, even to be a housekeeper or a butler, kind of those kinds of tasks, that the element of communication, since that's more advanced, that they can serve as companions, and that's what people are hoping humanoid robots might start out as being.
And it's already there, actually, Cindy, in not necessarily in the form of robots or humanoids, but if you think about the AI assistants like Alexa or a Google Home, they already give us a glimpse of these type of interactions. And there are some pet robots that are used, are very popular, like Able is one case of them. It looks like a ball, and people interact with them. And with large language models, this interaction becomes more human-like.
Gabe, you want to add to that as far as the role of companion robots and what people are looking to as the potential for that? I understand. It's just, I mean, it's basically because this chatbot technology, as long as it's placed in something that looks more human, people feel like, here's something they're talking to as a friend or as a family member even.
So I guess to me, I always think of robotics as about a robot that's taking actions in the environment, and in the physical world. And so for me, maybe I would classify a companion a little bit less as like under my definition of what a robot is, but and just more like what ChatGPT already is. But I can see that giving it a physical embodiment can definitely change the way that people perceive it, even if that embodiment's not being used to do things.
Right. Well, apparently there's a lot of excitement in the world of tech firms and scientists outside of academia as well, that they're kind of racing to have the first really, effective humanoid robot. In fact, Elon Musk, I guess, said that, Tesla's building this humanoid called Optimus and that he's claimed it's going to be the biggest product ever in history. Gabe, back to you about that. Is it fair to estimate about how many years that would be that this biggest product in history is going to be a reality?
So I do think that a lot has changed in the past maybe 5 years in robotics, where before I would have said, I just don't have an estimate for when this type of product can be built. And now I would say that we're definitely on a path to this kind of useful robot. I do think that, if people are saying it's going to happen in 1 year, then they're not taking into account a lot of constraints on the development of the technology and manufacturing and adoption. And so I think people overestimate what will happen in 1 year or 2 years when they're making, especially like some of those companies making their predictions. But I also think people can underestimate what can happen in 10 years, and that like even if the predictions are a little bit faster than I would say, they're directionally correct.
Yeah, I mean, when we think about what's happened in 10 years, where we are now with what is happening with AI, it's going to just be exponentially faster, I would imagine. Well, we do need to take a quick break. We are talking about humanoid robots. Give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Oh, hello. I don't believe we have been introduced. R2-D2, a pleasure to meet you. I am C-3PO Human Cyborg Relations. I beg your pardon, but what do you mean, naked? My parts are showing. My goodness. Oh.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Han, and that was C-3PO being introduced in the Star Wars movie Phantom Menace. He's one of the many examples of humanoid robots that capture our imagination. We're talking about what real robots are capable of today and what is the stuff of science fiction. My guests are Fernando Nascimento. He's Assistant Professor of Digital and Computational Studies at Bowdoin College. And Gabe Margolis is a PhD student with the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT. We invite you to join the conversation. Would you ever want to have a humanoid robot of your own? Why or why not? Email us at talk@mainpublic.org or comment on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. And joining us on the line now is Nicholas Giudici. He's professor at the University of Maine and chief research scientist with the VEMI Lab. Thanks for calling in, Nick.
Hi there.
Hi. So we've been talking about humanoid robots, and you focus on a kind of robot that's related, the four-legged type of robot. Tell us about how you got interested in this field of quadruped robots.
Yeah. So, my high-level interest is in just kind of how humans interact with robots, so kind of different from the technical and engineering factors, kind of what you could think of as a human-robot collaboration, or I think of it as kind of how the human intelligence communicates with the artificial intelligence. And one of the areas that I've been interested in, this is with a team at UMass as well, is in robotic guide dogs. So I'm myself a guide dog user, and, have worked with a dog for over 30 years. And there's times, I mean, I've always kind of been against these types of robots because they haven't worked well, and there's some changes that maybe we'll talk about briefly that kind of explains why they're working better. But what the robotic guide dog does is provides information about the environment as you're walking around, very similar to an animal guide dog. So if there's something in the path, if there's a curb in front of you, it stops. It helps to go straight across the street. But the thing that's excited me about robotic guide dogs is that they can do all that, but they also can do lots of stuff the animal dog can't, right? So it can have a navigation system. So I can say, hey, let's go to the store. Let's go to the pub. People think you tell your animal, I tell my dog that and he does that, but he really doesn't. I have to know where to go. So you could say you could be using computer vision and AI to find objects. So, hey, can you find a trash can? Can you find a bench? Tell me the geometry of this intersection. Help me know the status of the lights. And I think where we're at now with the technology and the sensors and the AI is getting us there. But what's also getting us there is my interest in the growing interest from robotics people who I'm working with in saying, well, how do we model the relation between the dog and the handler or the user? So we're not just making a robot, but we're making a robot that simulates that interaction.
Well, so how far along is the research then? I mean, how is this something that's closer to being a reality?
Yeah, I mean, there's as was mentioned earlier, there's certainly quadruped robots, and I think that's been a huge advantage. So these things started out as like wheeled vacuum cleaners, these big things that would kind of pull you around. And wheeled robots don't work well for the real world if you're trying to go upstairs or, go places that aren't flat. And also, you don't just want to be pulled around. You want it to be able to communicate with the device. So the technology is there, but there's a lot of things that are still being developed in those dynamics with the user.
Right. Well, gosh, it sounds like great potential for that. Thank you for sharing that and giving us a call, Nick. Nicholas Giudici is with UMaine. He's a professor and chief research scientist with the VEMI Lab. And Gabe, this is an area that you work on as well. Like you mentioned before, you've done quite a bit with quadrupeds, meaning four-legged creatures. I would think there's some advantages over two-legged ones, right? It's a little bit easier to make it just stand up.
Yeah, they're definitely more stable. I mean, even if you just kind of command a two-legged robot to stand still, you actually need some potentially complex algorithms depending on what it looks like. But for a four-legged robot, you can just kind of have it stand and balance. Also, for walking over different rough terrains, stairs, things like that, you definitely get some stability and payload benefits with four legs.
Yeah, great. I'm going to read an email from Maggie. She writes, I'm not sure I need a human-like robot, but robotics has done amazing work helping spinal cord injuries. Just to mention one, this I like. Comments. So yeah, robots doing surgery, all those kinds of things. Gabe. That's an ever-present benefit that's just getting better and better, correct?
I think so. And yeah, I think surgery is one pretty interesting example to kind of think about two different paradigms of teaching robots, where one is the paradigm I described before, which is learning in simulation and kind of exploring to find the right solution. And the other is learning from human demonstrations, kind of a watch and learn imitation setup. So I think especially for things like surgery, they're really difficult to simulate. And so a robot might learn much better by watching human doctors or being teleoperated by a human doctor and recording those motions. Whereas, yeah, learning in simulation for surgery might be really difficult because it's hard to simulate humans. But I think, yeah, both technologies are advancing.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff happening. I do have a note here from our producer that we're having phone issues. I've told they've been resolved. So if you did try to call in earlier and couldn't get through, please try again. I think they're working. And the number is 800-399-3566. I'm going to read an email from Kathleen. She writes, I am the elderly mother of a disabled middle-aged adult. She lives on her own but has staff from 9 in the morning until 9 at night. She requires staff for safety and occasional physical support, as well as assisting her if she falls and when she's sick. At night, she's alone from 9 p.m. until 9 a.m., but is remotely monitored by a camera system. There is no human in the home. Sometimes she'll lose power, or there'll be a bee flying around in the apartment, or her internet password won't work. These things all become a crisis. Does either of the guests see a future where robots would be able to fulfill staff needs for people with disabilities who need help? Some of the time, not all of the time. It would also be nice if they could be a companion and have some form of intelligent socialization together. And Fernando, I know that your work involves a lot of that more human side of what these advancements might mean. So do you have any comments to share with Kathleen?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that there are already many examples of robots that are trying to help with these types of problems. And some robots can help to dispense medicine, for instance. They can do small tasks at home, but you have to adapt part of the houses so the robots can operate. Another part of her question that is something that's already been used a lot, I mentioned ABLE, for instance, as an example of one robot that does that, is companionship and emotional support. So there are already many available social robots that are being used to reduce loneliness, to work as companion for elderly people. And then it raises all sorts of ethical questions. How much do we want to outsource that human activity to robots? But in some cases, as the listener described, it might be the only solution. So then you have a very interesting ethical argument to use robots in that situation, right?
I understand there's a course you teach on this, and you talk about some of those next level considerations if someone is serving as a companion, an AI companion. And for example, a lot of times it's sort of this feedback loop or whatever that they're kind of programmed to agree with you and to just not really be like a real human being who might, you know, argue or discuss points. How does that come into play?
Oh, yeah. If you think about a scenario, for instance, today we have this AI companions, and the kids are already interacting with the AI companions. And one thing that some studies observed is that kids change their behavior because they learn to interact with those machines. So a very interesting question is, what's the impact on socialization when we start to have robots everywhere in our relationship? So the possible use of robots for education or social companions, for instance, they raise questions about emotional development, social empathy development, and how kids would translate the relationship they have with machines to other human beings. Also, there is a question of empathy itself. Every time we outsource the relationship, the human-human relationship, we are also outsourcing part of our humanity. And those are very intrinsic questions that our society will have to decide on how it wants to manage and when it wants to manage this type of replacement.
I know this is a whole topic of its own, but when you say outsource your humanity, what does that mean?
It means, for instance, when someone who needs help is now being helped by a robot, another human being is missing the opportunity to interact with the human fragility in that person. It's not only about that person gets help, it's that humanity as a whole loses something. Some cultures, they realize more than others the importance of this wisdom and even the suffering experiences that humans have in the interaction with other humans. And that's the outsourcing question that I was talking about.
Oh, very philosophical. Gabe, in the process of working on the technology, do the folks at MIT have to still think about these elements at the same time?
Definitely. And I mean, I think it's kind of hard to predict how people will eventually adopt robots and where this leads in terms of kind of if you can truly make a general purpose robot that can do a lot of human work, then how does the economy and social structure of the world get reshaped? And what are people doing with their time? And what are they relying on a robot for or a human? I think as a researcher, I mean, the most important thing that I want to do is just to make the capabilities of the technology transparent as it's being developed, so that, you know, society can think about it together and kind of predict where it's going. But yeah, I think we're still far from that. Like, I think we need to see some deployments and how it's being adopted to get a better handle on what the future looks like there.
Yeah, a lot evolving at the same time. Here's an email from Nate in Portland. It says, I grew up watching Star Wars and Star Trek and used to be very optimistic about robots and AI becoming part of life and society. I found, though, that the closer we get to that being reality, the more I see the downsides, like security and privacy concerns, and the less I look forward to it. So, Fernando, you did touch upon that, even with the idea of a companion robot is also collecting information at the same time, right? So there are dangers.
Yeah, that's such a great question, Joe. Just these past weeks, we have been hearing about teenagers interacting with AI companions. They do not have robot bodies, but they are AI companions. There are some companies developing and deploying those companions. And one key question is, who owns the data of those conversations, of those interactions? Because people will talk about private conversations and so deep problems that they have with those robots, and they will be potentially recording it and reusing it in other contexts. So we really want to think very carefully as a society, what are the privacy guardrails that we want to impose when these systems are deployed? Because we have to keep in mind that every interaction is potentially being recorded.
Yeah, something we all think about right now, right? But along the lines of safety and security, Gabe, on the physical side of things too, in creating a humanoid robot, there's some just problems with physical safety for the user and I guess for the robot in terms of, like, you know, the creating something that's always able to keep its balance and not, you know, either explode or fall on somebody, right?
Definitely. And I think it's useful to think about self-driving cars to understand kind of where this is heading, because there's now Waymo has these self-driving car fleets deployed in cities, right? And in general, they're reducing accidents And because of that, I think they're allowed to deploy them. I think if Waymos had a higher accident rate than human drivers, it would be hard to justify deploying them. But it can't necessarily be, you know, rigorously proven that a Waymo is safer. It's just kind of an empirical thing. You deploy them and you find out. And for a long time, they were more dangerous. So I think there's a long road ahead of developing the technology to make it safe. But at some point, even if there are risks, it may also be the case that, you know, you can't afford to not adopt it in some sense, because the benefits just outweigh the risks. And I mean, Waymos, they really are robots, and they are susceptible to a lot of the same. I mean, they could be hacked, they could have lots of issues. And, you know, we may also deal with those problems in self-driving cars before we reach them in humanoids. That's another thing.
Yeah, that's a great parallel, because I remember just a few years ago saying, oh my gosh, are they ever going to really get these self-driving cars going? And then there they are driving around right now. So, but yet still a lot of bumps in the road to figure out. So we'll talk more about this. We are going to take another quick break. We're talking about humanoid robots and their potential role in society. Our phone number is 800-399-3566. If you tried that earlier, it should be working now. This is Maine Calling. We will be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Cindy Hahn. We're learning why robots with human properties are such a focus of the tech world and what they can and cannot do yet, and also why they're everywhere in popular culture as well. Joining me, Gabe Margolis with MIT and Fernando Nascimento with Bowdoin College. Share your comments and questions. Do you think robots can become just like us someday, and should they? Email us at talk@mainpublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram, or call 1-800-399-3566. Again, that phone wasn't working quite right earlier. If you tried, try again. Now, a clip that we'll listen to from the film Ex Machina, which featured a very human-seeming and beautiful female robot who displays emotions.
Hello.
Hi.
I've never met anyone new before. Have you?
None like you. She's incredible.
The challenge is to show you that she's a robot and then see if you still feel she has consciousness.
Do you want to be my friend?
Of course.
Will it be possible?
Why would it not be?
So, Fernando, you watched that movie, right? Ex Machina? Okay, you did.
Yeah.
Okay, the classic plot line in so many movies with robots is that they become too human. They usually become evil and they want to take over and conquer the humans, or in more romantic way, they get emotions and they feel love. So given how fast AI is developing in some ways, is this really as far-fetched as it sounds?
No, I don't think it is. Actually, there's another movie called Her. And the theme is very similar. And the person falls in love with the voice. In that case, it's a voice in a computer and smartphone.
It's Scarlett Johansson. So
yes.
With her great voice, but, yeah.
Yeah, but if you use some of the LLMs today and you start talking to them, because they have voice interfaces now, it's really impressive how close we are to those types of interactions. And actually, people currently, they are falling in love with LLMs. So imagine when we, on top of the voice, we also add embodiment. We have this tennis, Gabe mentioned that at the beginning. There's something called theory of mind. We try to, we typically as humans, we project that other entities have mind as we do. Human-like behaviors. So now we have language that's one of the most distinctive features of human beings that can be replicated artificially, and then you add that to embodiment. I think that we are not that far from, and particularly when we think about scenarios like Ava in Ex Machina or Samantha in Her, that the tech, the mechanical dexterity that Gabe mentioned might not be so important. It's more about social relationships.
Yeah, but Gabe, actually, in terms of, you know, in that movie, and in Murderbot, the TV series that's now happening, I mean, obviously they use the actors and the actresses so they look like people and they're supposed to be robots. But that side of the development of humanoid robots, of just actually making the skin or the hair or whatever look realistic, is that something that's a whole separate field of that people working on?
Yeah, so there's definitely a separate field of people who are trying to make, yeah, robots with a very human appearance or human-like expressions. And I guess that is kind of in the middle between, you know, chatbot and robot development, where it's a robot that's really designed with a social goal. I think I definitely generally think of the risks of chatbots as very distinct from the risks of robots. Kind of the societal and social risks of a human level chatbot are pretty difficult to reason about, but there are some obvious pitfalls. Robotics, if you think of, at just the motor skill level, I think it's more like a regular technology. Like, we have a new machine that can do some new things.
Yeah, a lot of different sort of segments to the development of robots. How competitive is this? Are robotic scientists all over the world collaborating, or are they competing to be like, we got the best one first?
Well, in the past few years, there's been a big increase in industry activity in robotics. And I think those companies are definitely competing to see who can create sort of the most capable humanoid robot product. And some are focused on homes, some are focused in factories. And I don't think any of them have had sort of a large scale deployment yet. And then also at universities around the world, there are researchers working on these robots. And I think that's much more collaborative. There are a lot of international conferences that folks go to. And I think everyone is working with the goal of both advancing the field forward and also communicating the capabilities of these robots to the public.
Well, what are the economic constraints on such a large scale production that people are hoping to do with humanoid robots? It seems like it would be vastly expensive.
Definitely. So, and actually, I was also thinking about this when we were briefly discussing, you know, a caretaker robot in your home. So I think that the cost of the robot is a big obstacle to adoption there. Like, it wouldn't be impossible to build a caretaker robot today, but the problem is if that robot costs many, many thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars, and all it does is this one function, like if something goes wrong in your home, it'll help you out, then that might not be a viable economic proposition for a lot of people. But if the same robot can also do your laundry, do your dishes, get your groceries, all of these different functions, suddenly, you know, you don't have to buy a different robot for each thing. You can buy one robot, put it in your home, and it does all of this stuff. Then that same price tag might seem much more reasonable because you're just going to pay it once and get all of this benefit out of it. And so I'm not so much, I don't think these companies are betting that these robots will become extremely, extremely cheap. I think they're betting that the capabilities will improve so that they actually justify the value. And that's really what's blocking them from scaling up the production right now.
Yeah, I read that some tech titans, just kind of to show off, will have a robot in their home that can like water the plants or bring someone a drink, but they don't even get it right all the time. Is that right, Fernando?
Yeah, it is. But also, the in terms of the economics, your last question, Cindy, there's a conundrum there to resolve. That is, what is the right moment to build the robot? Because technology advances so fast that if you start building up thousands or hundreds of thousands of robots, and then next month there's a big, like Gabe developed something completely new, you would have to recall those robots, like the physicality of the robots. They impose limitations to economics as well.
Good point. Thank you. We're getting some fun Facebook comments here. One from Linda. I enjoyed Marvin, the depressed robot in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Universe. So there's a good example. And a Facebook comment from Jeff. Regarding robots in film, the computer HAL in 2001 Space Odyssey. It's a tip to IBM. HAL, the H-A-L, precedes the letters in IBM. So a little fun robot fact there. And there's a question from Scott. He wants to know if you can talk about robotic pets and their impact on mental health. Gabe, with your quadruped work, is that something that is one of the goals that they could serve?
So I guess I'm not too familiar with their impact on mental health. I definitely think having, robot guide dog could have a lot of benefits and other kind of companion robots like that. At the same time, I mean, my personal opinion, I do have a robot dog at home. My dad has a real dog, and I think I definitely enjoy hanging out with the real dog a lot more from a companionship perspective right now. So I think they've got a long way to go.
Is your robot dog at home one of the like toys you can get in the store, or something you actually made?
No, one of the, kind of like, yeah, research
from your lab. Okay. Yeah. Not just something you buy at the toy store. Okay. Fernando, what about the role of, the companionship element in mental health of a robot as a pet?
Yeah. And there are already robots being used that in some research, like solid research reports that they can be very helpful for elderly people, for instance. So in terms of reducing anxiety, cases of dementia, for instance, the robots do not have the same type of reactions that humans have with that type of interactions. But again, what types of human behaviors do we want to let robots take over? That's a very important ethical question. And the other one is the relationship between empathy and manipulation. When you're interacting with these robots or these pets, you never know how much they are really empathizing with you, which in a certain way they can't. And what's the threshold between perceiving manipulation? And that's something that AI, again, embedded into the robots can make a difference, because AI has something that's called reinforcement learning, that they can learn as we interact with them. So they will get better at understanding what we do. So just think about your dog when they realize, or when it realizes that you want to go out for a walk. They have certain behaviors, right? And the robots may start learning those behaviors as well.
Interesting. We will be talking next week for another show on AI on Thursday, October 2nd, about AI in our everyday lives and how people are just using them day to day. So we'll continue some of what you just mentioned next week. Just for fun, before we run out of time, either of you share any favorite robots? I know you mentioned Data already, but Gabe, did you have an absolute favorite robot growing up or currently in popular culture?
Well, I think for me, I enjoyed as a kid playing with Lego Mindstorms robots, not exactly popular culture, but some super fun kits that got me started out with that. So that's what I would have to go with.
That clearly launched your current career. So that's great. And Fernando, what else made an impression on you or that you're currently, there's a lot out now that has robots in it.
Oh, yeah. But I just wanted to go back to the listener's question, and when he mentioned HAL, the HAL robot, because it raises the question of the threshold. The key point of HAL is it decides that it doesn't want to be turned off, and then it opens up a set of new questions at how much can we take control of these entities, and what do they have rights after all. There's another book I would recommend for the listeners, Clara and the Sun by Ishiguro, and in which he discussed these questions. The Rosie, the robot there, is another wonderful robot to look at.
Great. Yeah. And I'll just close with an email from Bruce. He says, as soon as we got our Alexa device, I asked all kinds of questions that 12-year-old boys would ask. I'm 62. So I asked her to open the pod bay doors and, whoops, I just lost it. Pod bay doors and, hold on. Sorry, it's not staying here. And this is what Alexa answered. I'm afraid I can't do that, Dave. I'm not Hal, and we're not in space. So there you go. Thank you both for joining us today. Fernando Nascimento is an assistant professor of digital and computational studies at Bowdoin College, and Gabe Margolis is a PhD student with the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Our theme music was composed by Mike Jandro. I'm Cindy Hahn, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.